From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Marketing Matters on Business Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Marketing Matters here on Business Radio, Sirius XM 132. I'm Barbara Kahn, the Patty and J.H. Baker Professor of Marketing, and I'm joined by my co-host, Americus Reed, the Whitney M. Young Jr. Professor of Marketing and the Brand Identity Theorist. Hello, Americus.
Hi, Barbara. Quick shout out to the Wharton Battle of the Bands. I was there last night with your husband.
Yes.
And it was a phenomenal event, seven bands. And one of the bands launched into Taylor Swift and the place erupted.
Really?
So it was really exciting.
And, he didn't tell me about that.
Yeah, it was crazy fun. So it's great to be here talking about all things retail, branding, marketing, segmentation, targeting, positioning, messaging. So what have we got on the show today?
Yeah, that sounds like an exciting night last night. But today, we're really excited to welcome Suzanne Kapner, one of my favorite reporters from the Wall Street Journal, who is always writing spot-on articles about what's happening in retail. And so we will discuss a lot of the top news stories in the retail world today, and we can all decide whether we think they're a hit or a miss. And then on our spotlight segment, we have Mark Singer, who's the Deloitte Digital's U.S. CMO. Chief Marketing Officer, and he's going to talk a lot about AI and what they're doing in Deloitte Digital. So that'll be really exciting.
Very exciting.
But let's start off with Suzanne. Hello, Suzanne.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So if we're looking at some of the articles that you've been writing, there's really a lot of news and a lot of potential change going on in retail. And you've written many articles about Macy's. The newest one was about them adding two directors to their board. But why don't you give us a little bit of background about why that's so important and what Tony Spring, who's the new CEO, has to face in thinking about what he's going to do with Macy's?
Sure. Well, this investor group last year had made an offer to buy Macy's, and Macy's rejected the offer initially. And then one of the investors launched a proxy fight. And with today's news and the appointment of these two directors, Macy's and this investor, Ark House Management, have settled their proxy differences. And Macy's is now sort of open to negotiating with these investors. They're providing some materials so the investors can conduct due diligence. Mm. So they really kind of, you know, reached an agreement not to proceed with their proxy fight, which is, you know, I think in the benefit of all parties involved.
Very cool. Before you launch into more detail here, I want to tap your brain a little bit, Barbara. Just for our listeners, give us a real quick, you're the retail guru, give us a real quick overlook of the landscape, brand-wise, Macy's, the players, all of what's going on. Just help us
and
get calibrated.
Suzanne, let me give a quick summary of the way I see it, and then I'd love to hear you give more detail because I think you know a lot more of the detail on it. But on a really big picture, you know, people are talking about the death of the department store,
right.
Macy's is kind of in the middle of the pack where they're not high-end, they're not... some of the TJ Maxx's and or Target or some of the low end. So they're really proverbial stuck in the middle. And Tony Springs took over at beginning of February. He was the CEO of Bloomingdale's, which is the part of the Macy's network that's doing better and is a more upscale brand.
Got it.
And he's come in and proposed a lot of strategies about retail theater, trying to bring more excitement into the stores. He's been closing a lot of stores. He's looking to make the footprint of the store smaller. But these people who are on the board and the people that she's just talking about have been talking about the idea that Macy's probably most valuable asset is their real estate. And whether or not they're leveraging their real estate properly is a different way to think about the business than from what works from a retail brand point of view.
Got it.
Suzanne, do you agree with that summary?
Absolutely spot on, Barbara.
Okay. That's good. You know, so it's a really interesting question whether or not, A, you know, it's too little too late and Macy's can't get back. Now, one of the things Tony Springs has said is he's going to prioritize Bloomingdale's and Bluemercury, which are two sections of their brand constellation that are doing better.
Didn't know Bluemercury was part of the game here.
Yeah, no. Bluemercury is their beauty retail outlet, and both of them are doing much better than Macy's in general. They're closing down some really big Macy's stores. And then how they can leverage the real estate piece of it and what they're willing to do. Whenever you see a real estate person come into these retail stores, they don't have the head of a merchant. And they really, a lot of times, end up hurting the retail business.
Oh, interesting.
So, and Tony Springs is somebody who has a lot of respect. I think people are really excited about what he's planning and what he's thinking. But really, the question is there still room in this world for a middle-of-the-road department store?
Interesting.
Suzanne, do you have personal thoughts about that?
What does the data show? What have you been seeing, Suzanne?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of, investors, especially real estate-minded investors, tend to look at this very differently than retailers do. And, you know, investors, they kind of want to make the quick buck. You can sell off this real estate, make a lot of money for shareholders. But in that tends to leave the retailer in a very bad spot.
Right. Mm.
If they have to sell their real estate and lease it back, then they're subject to rising rents. And we've seen retailers over the years who have done this go out of business as a result. And Macy's really does not want to follow that path. But maybe there is some middle ground where they can, you know, develop some of their real estate in a more creative way that would unlock some value without sort of giving away all their, you know, valuable pieces. So that's one part of it. And then, you know, Tony does come from a very interesting background. He's much more of a merchant. And, he has some interesting ideas about how to revive Macy's. That's all going to, unfortunately, come up against the fact that they're just playing in a very tough space. That middle of the road department store space is not a growing channel. And they have a lot working against them. And so it's going to be, you know, difficult. But I'd be willing to see what he can do, because I think he has some very interesting ideas, and it would be nice to see Macy's revived a bit.
Oh, my God, it really would. I mean, I still think there's a role for Macy's in the U.S. landscape.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea of bringing back a merchant's eye, whenever we've seen retailers really do well, it's when somebody comes in with a new point of view. You know, historically, Mickey Drexler, the merchant prince, would come in with a new eye and get people excited about going into retail. Even we had America's daughter, who's Gen Alpha, on our show, and she was talking about how excited she is to run into Sephora, who's been playing around with a lot. That's a legacy brand, but they've been playing around with a lot of brands, a lot of excitement. And you could imagine that Macy's, in the right way, could get it fun to shop in Macy's again. It just hasn't been fun to shop in Macy's for a really long time.
So, Barbara, how do I become a merchant prince? That sounds like an amazing gig.
You got to have the eye.
I clearly don't have the eye. Yeah.
You know, J. Crew, he did J. Crew for a while. Like, what's the up-and-coming new brands? Aloe right now is a brand people are super excited about. Yeah. You know, it's something about getting the product, getting the excitement back into the store. And that's what people are hoping that Tony Springs can do. Mm. And he's trying to do it in a more efficient way, because he has these big stores that are not useful anymore. He needs a much smaller footprint store, and he needs the stores in the right place.
Interesting.
So, you know, Macy's is an ongoing fight. We'll see how that happens. But you've written about, Suzanne, some other retailers that are kind of interesting in thinking about what their model is. One of the ones that really hit me when I read it when it first appeared, which was a couple weeks ago, was this story you wrote about Brandy Melville. Tell Americus what that brand is.
Well, it sells clothing to teenage girls, and mainly they mainly sell in one size fits most, or small and extra small sizes.
Wow.
So they're geared to a smaller young woman, and that has outraged some of the larger young women, especially as we've seen more and more retailers tilt toward offering extended sizes, plus sizes. As Americans are getting bigger, more retailers are adding larger sizes. Brandy Melville has held steadfastly to its aesthetic of dressing that smaller woman. And the smaller girl then on social media will sort of punch back and say, hey, you know, larger people now have so many places to shop. Why can't us small girls have a store that's, fits us well? So there's been this real tug of war and this debate on social media over the brand.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, you started off by saying, tell us about segmentation, targeting, and positioning.
Right,
they have a very clear niche.
Wow.
The problem with the niche, which Suzanne wrote in her story, is that there's some kind of value judgment going on with it.
Yes.
So there's
yes.
a prestige and status uh-huh. associated with people who can fit into this brand.
Gotcha.
And if you can't fit into this brand, it gives some young girls body image issues. Ooh. And so what's the role? You know, I'm curious, actually, since you said segmentation, targeting, and positioning, what is your thought about this? Because it is a really, it's a good strategy
it
in terms of being a niche.
It
just has ethical overtones.
That's a great way to characterize it, Barbara. I think that, you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity in customer needs, as Suzanne was talking about, in the retail environment, trying to connect with those consumers who have those specific needs. I think it's tricky. I think perhaps, you know, the idea that the tribe will come out and say, hey, you know, we're not shaming anybody, but we need stuff because our bodies have a certain fit and all of that. What's wrong with that? And I think the overtone is, you know, I think about stepping into that hornet's nest, because the story has – great stories have a hero and a villain and, you know, and this kind of thing. So it's sort of, how do you – if you're that brand, how do you not become the villain? How do you not become that – I remember what's the brand? Lululemon. And, you know, the sort of head leadership sort of saying, hey, you know, this is who we are. We're not really for this body type. So tough, you know what, if you can't really fit in our stuff. So I think it's interesting. But I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence as to whether or not you immediately go to the gray nuances of the ethical morality question here, or if there's just a legitimate, pure segmentation argument that's at play here. What are your thoughts?
No, it is interesting you bring up Lulu, because Victoria's Secret did that too. It's not unusual for some of these retailers to not carry bigger sizes,
yeah.
or else to put the bigger sizes in the back,
right.
because they want to have certain people in their store and in their clothes.
That's right.
But they've gotten incredible pushback.
Brandy, and we'll say the brand again?
Which one?
The brand that we were talking about. That's
Brandy Melville.
Brandy Melville. Is that a person? Is that a person?
I don't know what the history is.
Is that some skinny
brand.
Like persona?
It's a made-up name.
That's a made-up name. So we don't want to bring Brandy, like, you know, there's a Brandy out there, but... That's shocking to me because at Barbara, we teach in the class, if you try to be for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. That's what she's saying. There's the debate on social media. And, you know, most of these brands who did this kind of, like you mentioned, Lulu, another really famous one is Abercrombie and Fitch, which was going after what's sexy on the college campus. And almost all of them have retrenched.
Interesting.
They are not taking that position anymore.
Gotcha.
I mean, Suzanne, I think you mentioned that in your article, right?
Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Abercrombie's had a great revival now, sort of moving very far away from its previous image of kind of that cool, preppy kid. And so that's in some ways what makes what Brandy Melville's doing so unique, because they seem to be going against the grain right now and really sticking with their niche when so many other brands are trying to kind of be more inclusive.
Interesting. No, what's interesting to me, Barbara, get your thoughts on this as well, Suzanne. When you do things like this, sometimes, and it would be interesting to do the thought exercise, what would happen if a certain contingent, ideological contingent of the population said, we love this because it's anti-woke? You know, and then suddenly people like rallied around this. Okay.
Well, that's kind of MAGA.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, okay, that's debatable. But you know what? You follow what I'm saying. It's like, what happens when this takes off and like perhaps people adopt this and like maybe misappropriate what the actual brand meaning is here? That could lead to some problems. And maybe that's why in a lot of the case examples, you're seeing people kind of pull back a little bit from that type of very specific,
yeah.
you know, clear, narrowing strategy.
I mean, I think that's really putting what the issue is, you know, what's happening here. So let's get down to it. I'll ask you, what do you think, America? Is their strategy a hit or a miss?
Oh, no. Ah, that's great. It's a hiss. It's definitely a mitt. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit when you were first describing it. But then when Suzanne talked about, hey, you know, the population of these people saying, hey, then what's wrong with, and I guess there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, these clothes are for our body type. The wrong part is what your analysis says, when there's an implication or an inference that the other body types are not welcomed here.
And by the way, we have one in Philly. I never went into it. It just never called out my name. And then I was thinking, like, maybe I should go. But it is really targeting young people, right, Suzanne? And that's part of what makes it.
So they don't want old skinny people.
Yeah, it's definitely
young women.
Yeah.
Young women are very vulnerable to, body image issues. And so, there is a moral complexity to it.
Yeah.
100%.
Do you want to weigh in, Suzanne, on whether it's a hit or a miss?
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Suzanne?
Well, if you go just by their sales, I would say it's a hit because the strategy has served them very, very well. Mm. But it's a tough one because, if it's true, if you try to be all things to all people, you're not going to really do very well. You need to pick a lane and you need to pick it in a way that's not offensive. And it's a tough line to walk. So,
it's a mid, all right.
The jury's out, as they say, Barbara.
So there's two other specialty retailers you've written about recently. I'm going to take the one you wrote a while ago first and then go to the one you wrote more recently, which is the Gap one. And the reason why I want to mention that is because, speaking of the merchant prince, Mickey Drexler, he is the one who turned around the Gap originally, brought in Old Navy, really came in with a merchant's eye and brought in really good product. Then they may have done a lot of strategies that weren't smart, like overstore and do all these other kinds
overstore.
Of things. Overstore. Build too many gaps.
You go
to a mall and there were six gaps. Why do you need six gaps in one mall?
There were
mall,
gaps inside of gaps. Yeah, we don't know why this happened.
But, it was just crazy. And so there's a lot of stuff like that they did. And
interesting.
When they introduced Old Navy, it kind of hurt indirectly Gap because it Old Navy was the trendy brand and then Gap wasn't. And Gap has been trying to turn itself around for a really long time. And it brings us back to the discussion we were having about Macy's. Is it too little too late? And what they're trying to do and what Suzanne wrote about is they tapped a fashion designer to come in as the creative director to try to bring kind of a new look to the store. Suzanne, do you want to add to that story?
Well, I think Zac Posen being the fashion designer is an important component, but you have to start with their appointment of the new CEO last year, Richard Dixon, who came from Mattel. And Richard was really kind of the brainchild behind Barbie's revitalization, making Barbie cool again. And he has tremendous marketing skills. He's a great marketer. And so he's really bringing that to bear with Gap. If you've seen, they have a linen campaign that's out now that's very reminiscent of the old Gap. The old Gap ads, you remember where people were like dancing in jeans or they had the celebrity photographs wearing Gap t-shirts. It's kind of hearkening back to that that era, that image. So he's kind of working his magic there. And then they brought in Zac Posen to be a creative director. And Zac is just very new. And I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet about his role there. And I don't think we've really seen his impact yet. But that's going to be interesting to watch because marketing is great, but you also need product. It's got to be the two working hand in hand.
Right.
And I was thinking about this. I have clothes from when Gap was cool, way back when, that I still own because they're very high quality, actually. They really wear really well. And that even before the campaign she was talking about, one of the really older campaigns was you'd get well-dressed celebrities wear luxury products, and they'd wear a Gap t-shirt underneath. So you would wear Gap for the basics and then use luxury for the accessories. And that's not a terrible positioning.
That's pretty cool.
And if they could have high quality, if you can imagine a prototypical cool Gap t-shirt that has some kind of styling and that really kind of holds up with good quality, I think there is a place in the market for Gap so that it doesn't necessarily have to be, done. They can really bring back Gap, possibly. They've revised, Levi's came back roaring, and some of these brands can really come back, so.
As long as you have a great brand, you can always be revived. Look at Gucci at one point was, left for dead. you've seen a lot of these revivals over the year. If you have that sort of brand history that you can draw from, it's always possible to bring it back.
And it's interesting you say that because, again, we're going to have to get these young people to bring back you know, to believe in the brand. And mm-hmm. do they know Gap vis-a-vis, and we'll talk about this when we get to the other story you talked about, Uniqlo. These young, you know, America's daughter, she just loves Temu and Shein. And, you know, that's a whole different point of view when you're
huge.
Buying stuff. And that has never been Gap's positioning particularly.
Right.
So do you have a sense on that? How you know, you said looking at the numbers and things. I mean, those brands, Temu and Shein, are doing that really, really well, right?
Shein is just exploded. And I saw a report. I think they said it was like the number one apparel brand now in the U.S.
Wow.
It has just grown extremely fast. But it's not for everybody. You know, it's low price, but also the quality is on the lower side. Mm. It's more for that younger generation. So I do think, you know, there is a place for retailers like Gap and Uniqlo that have higher prices, but also higher quality.
Interesting.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. This Gap, I mean, just as a testimony to Gap, it's like 30 years old, my t-shirt, and it's great. I have a few of them, and they're my favorite ones.
Interesting.
So it's an interesting kind of positioning, especially if you can get a designer mm-hmm. who can really bring in the product. Mm-hmm. It's not just any old t-shirt. It's a Gap t-shirt, that, you know, something special, the neckline or the sleeves or something. I don't know
something special. Interesting. Tell me about this Shein. What was the name of this brand, Barbara, you just were talking about with Suzanne?
Temu and Shein.
How do you say the second one?
Shein.
Yeah. What's the psychology of like low quality? I heard low quality, low price. What's the psychology?
But
what's it? Is it shabby chic?
Talks about it. Shop like a billionaire.
Shop like a billionaire and buy like real cheap shit.
Yeah. Because eyes would just light up when she talked about it.
Yeah.
She could afford all of these new fashion things.
Yeah.
And the fact that they fall apart is not a problem.
No big deal. I still feel like a billionaire.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. She kept repeating that slogan, shop like a billionaire.
And it's because you can get lots and lots of stuff. You can feel like you have a wealth of things, and that translates into this, like, I have abundance. Oh.
And, you know, you think about these young people. They are growing, so they outgrow clothes.
Yeah, so it doesn't
matter. Fashion matters a lot. They're not necessarily into classic.
Yeah, that's true.
They want to be new and trendy, and, you know, So it's a very different positioning.
Yeah.
But do you know any other retailers that are holding the position we're talking about for Gap? I don't know. I mean, J. Crew maybe, I guess.
In that sort of classic space?
Yeah.
Yeah, Uniqlo is definitely known for its classics. In fact, so much so that I think they had problems when they first came to the U.S. because they were seen as a bit too basic. They didn't have enough fashion. And now they're having a reboot here. And still the vast majority of what they sell are their basics, like their heat tech. They're known for like technology, like their heat tech long underwear and their down jackets. But they have added some more fashion pieces.
See, now I do think Uniqlo and Gap can have unique positioning. Like I think Gap could come in with kind of a very basic, high quality t-shirt type of design that kind of catches eye. And Uniqlo, I agree with Suzanne. When I think of Uniqlo, I do think of the tech. Mm. Like I don't think of it as just the same as everything else. You buy a Uniqlo down vest or their Heath Tech long underwear and stuff. It's really well designed for warmth.
Interesting.
And so it brings technology into the clothing. It's basic, but you're using it more functionally than necessarily fashion driven.
Interesting.
And it is, I think Uniqlo is cheaper than, it's a lower priced retailer than some of these others. You know, and that brings back, like, is there a place for Zara and H&M and those kinds of brands? Mm-hmm. Suzanne, have you written articles about them recently?
You know, my colleagues in Europe cover them more closely. I'm obviously familiar with them, and Zara continues to do well. H&M has had some stumbles in recent years, but, you know, I do think there is a place for both of them as well. You know, they Zara does an amazing job with they are truly fast fashion, like the leader of the pack in terms of how quickly they can get items to their stores. I mean, Shein is probably like their closest competitor in terms of turnaround time and, you know, jumping on getting the fashion trends right and getting them to stores quickly. Both Zara and Shein are sort of masters in that area.
And we only have time for one more story probably, but, you know, we're also looking at the luxury market. The luxury market has been softer recently. A lot of the people who buy aspirational luxury are not buying. The high end is probably still okay. I think Hermes is still doing fine. But the luxury is softer than it used to be, and people are worried about those numbers coming out. And the two luxury retailers that here in the U.S. are Neiman Marcus and Saks. And Saks made the controversial decision a while ago to separate their online business from their in-store business and you know, along the lines of looking for the money, looking for profitability. Not sure what Neiman's been doing recently, but do you have any news on the Neiman and Saks story?
Well, they, you know, it's been reported now for a while these two have been in talks trying to merge. And they've been in on-again, off-again talks for years, going back like a decade at least. And this is sort of just the latest attempt. And the thinking is, you know, you combine these two and you get, you know, more leverage with some of your suppliers. You have to understand that the brands they sell now, like Louis Vuitton, all the LVMH-owned brands, you know, LVMH is a monster, a giant. It's so much larger than Saks or Neiman or any of these smaller retailers. So by combining, they would have a little bit more leverage to negotiate with some of these bigger European luxury houses. They could strip out duplicating costs, maybe close some overlapping stores, and just kind of have a, you know, stronger front as a united company. That's, you know, that's the thinking there. And so we'll see if they can pull it off, but they've been in on-again, off-again talks and trying to work out a deal.
The way you describe it, it makes so much sense. I mean, because not only, you know, are they much smaller than the powerhouse LVMH or maybe even Kering, but a lot of those brands are going direct. And those, a lot of what, when they do come into the into these department stores, it's kind of on a leasing basis, not on a normal retail basis, and they call the shots. They have all the power in this relationship. So as you lay this out, it kind of makes sense for Saks and Neiman to kind of join forces. So what's the hang up there? What are the some of the roadblocks that are making it less likely to happen?
You know, it, and then a lot of these deals, it comes down to price, right? How much Neiman wants, how much Saks is willing to pay, and kind of working through some of the details there.
Interesting.
Yeah, really, because those are other iconic stores. I would love to see them stay around and do really well, but we'll see.
Interesting.
That's any possibility. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about some really big stories in retail.
Huge
I mean,
stuff.
We're talking about disruption in this landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not over yet. We'll see how it all pans out. And I've seen you've written many stories on Macy's. That's like one of the biggest things that people are paying attention to. What's going to happen to that department store?
100%.
So thank you so much for joining us today. And where can our listeners go to read these stories and keep up with you?
The Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Suzanne.
To you.
Really appreciate
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for listening today. We'll be back next week. Till then, this has been Marketing Matters. I'm Barbara Kahn, here with America's Read, Business Radio, Sirius XM 132.